Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
For indeed there are many lessons to be learned from the adventures of Robin Hood, told in its myriad forms and versions. Some of the earliest ballads have Robin being just an ordinary thief, an ordinary outlaw, not a noble person righting wrongs. But other legends developed, and there's a huge scholarly output on which stories developed when, and a great deal about debate whether it's properly the 12th century or the 13th century, or maybe even the 14th century of the Common Era. So even the connections with King Richard are dubious, but, you know, it's sort of like other sacred texts. It builds up over time. So adventures from faraway times and places do capture and hold the imagination of children and adults. Because even as I talk about the adventures of Robin Hood this morning, we can recall fairy tales, you know, stories of ancient history that passed on orally, not just in textbooks. Some of them get made into TV series, such as The Era of Chivalry, in a series that lasted 1 year, I think it was 1956-57, called The Tales of Lancelot, of Sir Lancelot, which, by the way, had the same producer as The Adventures of Robin Hood, for those of you who aren't up on your 50s TV lore, which I hope is most of you, because this is really, in some ways, frivolous. But the stories are so great. I mean, and most of my experience of Robin Hood until recently was from that TV series, which ran for 4 years, 143 episodes, and Classics Illustrated Comics. At some point, I did read a chapter book about Robin Hood, but I can't remember what it was. Except somehow in the end, Robin gets knighted in that version, yet in many of the other stories, he's already a knight at the start. So, I was 6 years old when the TV series began, and my older brother and I avidly watched it. And those of you who may remember, there's this opening scene that says, starts with the horn fanfare, and there's a picture of Richard Green, the star, drawing back his longbow, letting go of the arrow, which flies through the air, hits a tree, and upspins the title and circles till finally becomes clear, The Adventures of Robin Hood. And I've been watching that on DVD the last few weeks, along with the stories, but that opening is riveting. It is such a fine piece of video or film craft. It's 15 seconds long, but it never ceases to excite the viewer. My brother and I played Robin Hood and Little John by battling with staffs, which are really fallen tree limbs in the woods near our house in Connecticut. And we had a fallen tree there that we would get on as if it were the bridge. There was no water underneath. We'd get the staffs and we'd fight, and sooner or later, one or both of us would wind up landing on the ground, which was considerably harder than a stream. But, you know, we played those things. We had toy bows and arrows. Unlike some of our friends, we weren't really allowed to have hunting bows. But we had toys. We had fun. Now, over the past few weeks, I have rewatched many of the 39 episodes shown during the first season of The Adventures of Robin Hood. Now, think about that just a little aside in today's TV series. 39 episodes. Now, they let up a little bit over the 4 years, so the average per season was only 32. What TV series today do 30, even 30 new episodes every season? None. And they'd film everyone in 4.5 days, from start to finish. And if you watch them, they are just amazingly well done, even having very effective scenery Even though you know that they're walking on the floor of a soundstage. But just carefully thought out and done. Remarkable stuff. Remarkable stuff. Well, I've rewatched 31 of those in recent weeks because I couldn't get copies of the other 8 or I would have watched those too. And I have some from later seasons. And they have that opening sequence, which I described, and then a little one verse to a ballad tune that is like a precis of the story that's going to happen, summed up in perhaps 16 or 18 words at the most. And then the story itself runs for about 23 minutes, and then you get the closing credits, which last about just over a minute. And that's when you hear, Robin Hood, riding through the glen. Well, here are some of the episodes, in brief, of that first season that tell the story in its particular version. And the first one is The Coming of Robin Hood, written, credited in the U.S. version to Ian McClellan and in the British version to Eric Heath. And just so you know, Eric Heath wasn't his real name, and I'll say more about that later. Ian McClellan was his real name, that writer. But oddly enough, the British version had one author and the American version another. Well, that first one, Sir Robin of Locksley, comes home from the crusade with King Richard to the Holy Land to find that Sir Roger de Lisle is living in his castle or manor house, and exploiting those who lived on the lands and Sherwood Forest that Robin's father had been keeper of on behalf of the king as well as his own lands. Robin asserts his title and goes to the court, learns that the Sheriff of Nottingham, believing that Robin was dead, killed in the Crusades, and they were also trying to spread the story that King Richard had been killed in the Crusades, but that was not true either. Robin goes to the court, proves his ownership, producing a letter from King Richard attesting to his identity and character, and the Sheriff of Nottingham agrees to allow him to reclaim his property and tells Sir Roger, who, by the way, was played by Leo McKern, who later starred in Rumpole of the Valley, of the Bailey decades later, tells Sir Roger that, you know, he doesn't have to leave if some unfortunate accident happens to Robin and he can't claim the estate. Sir Roger is very dumb, but eventually gets the point. So when Robin goes to reclaim the estate and Roger to sign his acknowledgement that he is not the true owner, Robin spots a shadow and sees a man with a longbow hiding behind a column. So as they're talking, Robin maneuvers so that Sir Roger is between him and the longbow, and when the arrow flies, Sir Roger is killed. Needless to say, the sheriff concludes that Robin is guilty of this killing, and that's when Robin, in this version, becomes an outlaw. So he goes off to join the outlaws in Sherwood Forest, led by Will Scatlock, who is first suspicious because Robin speaks such high-class English and is dressed so well, but then comes to trust him and says, "What is your name?" And he starts to say Robin of, and says, "Just Robin," because he didn't want them yet to know that he was himself a knight. But in the second legend, in the second episode, and I'm not going to go through all 39, believe me, it would be fun, but this is written by Ian Larkin and Eric Heath. Herbert of Duncaster, a dishonest money lender charging usurious rates of interest, is relieved of his purse by Robin and Albert. The bandits return the money to those villagers and farmers from whom it had been collected. This led to a skirmish in which Will Scatlock is mortally wounded. He's taken back to the camp in the forest, and on his deathbed appoints Robin to succeed him as the leader of the outlaws. And that in that version is how Robin becomes the leader of the men in Sherwood Forest. And of course, there are 37 more episodes, like I said. I'm not going to go through them all. The story by which he meets Friar Tuck is very similar to the comic book version. And it's really impressive to watch Robin and Tuck dueling with Tuck holding up his robes so he doesn't trip over them. And these sorts of adventures go on and on, pointing out the unfair taxation of the tenants of the land owned by the lords of the manor, the taxation, exploitive taxation, and sometimes even blackmail of craftspeople. And the merry men of Sherwood, respond to people in various sorts of need. At one point, Friar Tuck calls upon them to help enable a young man whom Friar Tuck, against the rules of church and state, has taught how to read, and who actually has turned into a very literate scholar. But his life is in danger, so he needs to be brought to a monastery where he can live in sanctuary and safety. And Robin and the men effect that, also bringing this young scholar's twin brother along, who is not literate, but also can come to have safety there and serve the monastery in another way than as a scholar. There's a story called The Sheriff's Boots, in which craftsmen in the village of Retford make softer and more comfortable boots than the bootmakers in Nottingham town. And the sheriff wants to know their secret, so his bootmakers can make leather that good, and they refuse to tell him. So they come in and try to extort and capture the men and take the secret away. And the men go into hiding so they're not captured. And when the sheriff's armed men come, the women fight them off and succeed in driving them out. There's all sorts of stuff going on. This is 1955. Think about this for a bit, the cultural challenges going on. And the last one I want to mention was the 39th show of that season, titled The Scientist. The scientist is Albertus of Oxford, a scholar who has learned how to make lenses and polish them. Now, this may truly be anachronistic in terms of the real history, but, there it is. And he shows the men in the forest how he can start a fire by concentrating the sunlight on a dried branch. And it turns out that he is in hiding, and this is why Friar Tuck have called upon Robin and his men to help. He is in hiding because it seems that he has figured out how to build a lens big enough and powerful enough to concentrate the light to set a ship on fire in the water. And he refuses to give that information over. So he is in hiding. And talking with the men in the forest, he talks of the Frenchman who figured out how to do this and said, no, this is too horrible to use, except on the infidels. And then he talks of the Muslim scientist who figured out how to build a lens this large and refused to allow it to be used, saying it's too horrible to be used, except maybe on the Christians. Now, Albertus thinks it's too horrible to use on anyone. So as he starts to make his escape, he gives the one copy of the computations to Friar Tuck and asks him to keep them for him. He says, I have them memorized. And then they go off to bring him to safety, but there's an ambush. Albertus is shot. He's brought back to the camp after the men fight the ambushers off. And as he is dying, he asks Friar Tuck for the paper with the computations. And Friar Tuck brings them to him, and he takes his lens, he shines a light on it, and destroys them. And so the computations die with him, and the weapon is not used. So there are some very challenging themes in these stories. Friar Tuck, for instance, is a learned and loyal son of the Catholic Church. But he's also a masterful swordsman, a lover of good food and drink, a supporter of others who do not want to go along with injustice, and overall a critic of what is unjust in the status quo. He encourages young lovers to flee arranged marriages and blesses their marriages and solemnizes them in the chapel of the shrine he tends in the countryside. He seeks Robin help in enabling newlyweds to escape to a new and free life. He breaks the law of church and state by teaching a serf to read and write. He recruits Robin to help that literate serf, I mentioned that story, and his twin brother escape to the monastery at Whitby. And he helps the scientist Albertus escape from the sheriff of Nottingham, who is seeking him on behalf of King John, Prince John, so he can use that to beat his brother King Richard's ships when they come back to England. Tuck, in a sense, sort of presages the revolutionary priests of the 20th century connected with liberation theology, and even the worker priests, as one scholar puts it, of Europe in the mid-20th century. In these stories, women have their own agency. They are their own moral agents. I didn't talk about Lady Marian Fitzwalter, but she is an important character as well. And she refuses to enter into arranged marriages. She refuses to listen to her uncle as she manages the family property while her father is at the crusade with King Richard. And Robin Hood, whom she knew as a child, since they were both from noble families, and she become great friends. In one version, they actually get married. Not in the TV series, though. And she is a great archer also, and a great horse person. So she has her own moral agency. In the village of Retford, the women beat back the sheriff's men when they come to try to steal away the secret of the soft leather tanning. And like I said, other women who refuse to marry their husbands, Friar Tuck and Robin, help escape the arranged marriages, the intended husband, and live their own independent lives. When taxes are unfairly extracted from the poor, be they farmers or millers or even landed gentry of Robin's class of origin, it is the task of the men of Sherwood to retrieve and redistribute the ill-gotten wealth, perhaps returning to the ones who paid it, and perhaps using trickery with cash as the bait to force a repayment by the tax collector, which is what happened in that story I mentioned earlier, that one episode. But they are not enemies of the state as such. Robin and his men are loyal to King Richard, whose brother has tried to usurp the throne from him, but of the enemies of the corrupt regime that gets between the righteous monarch, or as historian E.J. Hobsbawm describes it in his book on bandits, in later centuries, even elected regimes, but who want to, the corrupt regimes that get in the way of the righteous monarch or elected president and his loyal subjects or citizens. This is a challenge to existing authority, but not to all authority. And certainly not to authority that is exercised wisely and honestly. And there is a powerful moral code at work, even if it involves breaking the law. As the newest Nobel laureate in literature puts it, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And certainly know if we go through Bob Dylan's oeuvre of work over the last 55 years, we'll probably find Robin Hood in there somewhere too. There are certainly other noble outlaws in his music. So Robin and his men are exemplars of honestly working within, in a sense, but against a corrupt system. They break the laws, but they also stay within a strict moral code. In most versions, Robin is himself the victim of the corrupt regime, a lower-ranked noble or knight whose sinecure has been seized. And Sir Robin of Locksley is outlawed, having been party to the death of the usurper to his estate, Sir Roger de Lisle. And I describe that story to you. But when he meets Will Scatlock, the leader, he is wearing a hood because he's hiding his identity now that he's a rat. He's fleeing from the law. And Will asks him, when he decides to accept him into the band, what is your name? And he starts to say, Robin. Oh, he says, oh, just Robin. And Will looks at the hood and says, how about Robin of the Hood? Robin says, that is fine. That's how he becomes Robin Hood in that story. Robin and his men rob only the rich and redistribute what they take to the poor. They are not self-aggrandizing. And in the second episode, after Will is mortally wounded and Robin becomes a leader, he becomes freer and in later episodes tells the men of his own background and the injustice he has suffered, which in Hobsbawm's story about the noble bandit, the noble outlaw, is also part of the story. Usually the noble outlaw is also someone who suffered an injustice. In spite of the medieval and feudal settings, the TV series conveys messages about individual rights in a very modern sense, about conflict between classes and the dangers of concentrated power that were relevant in the 1950s and are relevant today. I told you about episode 39, The Scientist, which in 1956, when it was first broadcast, certainly spoke to the fears of nuclear weapons that were spreading at that time. And I don't know about you, but I remember seeing bomb tests on television. Now, the producers and many of the writers of The Adventures of Robin Hood, though it was a British TV series, were American liberals and leftists, including many communists. Although not all were communists, many were victims of the Hollywood blacklist that began with the arrest, trial, and imprisonment of the Hollywood Ten in 1947. Between them, two of the ten, Adrian Scott and Ring Lardner Jr., who went by the name of Eric Heath for these purposes, wrote at least a quarter of the 39 episodes of the first season. The producer was another American, Hannah Weinstein. She was blacklisted just after 1950. So she moved to England, where she was able to get backing for the TV show. And she recruited these fine writers she knew who could not get work in Hollywood anymore, as well as British writers of similar sensibilities. The themes of the first season continued through the remaining three seasons, and other blacklisted writers, including Howard Koch, Waldo Salt, and Robert Lees, were among those who wrote the first season and also for later seasons. The Adventures of Robin Hood was one of the most popular TV series of its time. Remember, there were only three networks then. You didn't have hundreds of channels. And it was on CBS. The scripts embody broad-based values of individual freedom and fairness, and some more specifically progressive values of economic equity and the rights of members of one class to challenge the power of those of the class over them, as well as the moral agency of women in society. Remember that the early 19th, and also challenges within the church to the hierarchy's alignment with the monarchy. Remember that in the early 1950s was a time when a well-organized and well-financed campaign sought to turn the U.S. from a secular democracy to a Christian-based polity, and they got as far as getting "In God We Trust" onto our currency, and "Under God" added to the Pledge of Allegiance. But I'll say more of that on November 3rd in the run-up to the election. In spite of its progressive and moral content, The Adventures of Robin Hood TV series is not preachy, and it is great fun. In retrospect, it was, for me, an entry into a complex critique of things as they are and the rules as we learn them, and a morally ambiguous path towards subverting the status quo. Now, I didn't figure that out till years later, but that's kind of where it came from. But it wouldn't necessarily go that way. It was not propagandistic. Ring Lardner Jr. said he had a lot of fun addressing current issues, but it wasn't heavy-handed. And the propagandistic TV shows of the 50s were mostly all conservative in their values. Lardner was pleased that writing for The Adventures of Robin Hood gave him plenty of opportunities to comment on issues in Eisenhower-era America, as he put it. He and the other writers did so by applying 20th century sensibilities to medieval Britain. Well, the model of a group of outlaws fighting injustice from the woods outside of society can appeal across the political and social spectrum. It's a classic trope through much of history, and not just in England, but in other European cultures and elsewhere. And it did so. And this TV series and the classic illustrated comic book were part of the mix that made the U.S. in the 1950s a time of conflicting cultural forces and political ideologies. Feudal outlaws were in a mix that included the Beats, who were, you know, Robin Hood premiered the same year as Howl was published, 1955. A time of conflicting cultural forces and political ideologies. Feudal outlaws were in that mix, as well as Pat Boone, Bob Hope, and other conservative entertainers. It really was a mixed up time. Today's mix is not the same, but it is truly mixed up. But the noble bandit and the hero that lives outside the law by a high moral code is a recurrent motif. It is neither a clarion call to anarchy nor the property of the right wing alone, though they are making a lot of use of it in their self-styled and so-called militias. When I look at the lists of workers in the entertainment industry that were blacklisted in the 40s and 50s, a number of whom worked on Robin Hood, I see a list of the best and the brightest in the literary and entertainment industry at mid-20th century. Some, like Pete Seeger and Harry Belafonte, became well-known leaders for peace and justice, as well as outstanding artists. In the 1960s, blacklisted performers such as Kim Hunter, Hazel Scott, and Zero Mostel became stars again. William L. Shirer, who had been fired by Edward R. Murrow because of his criticism of the news slant, became the author of the best-selling Rise and Fall of the Third Reich and other nonfiction books. There were hundreds more. It was, as Lillian Hellman titled her memoir of that time, Scoundrel Times. So in the midst of today's struggles, contradictions, and confusion, we could do worse than take some lessons from a popular entertainment that came out of the turmoil of an equally confusing and scary time, but promoted honesty, equity, empowerment, and solidarity as it challenged the status quo. So enjoy your Robin Hood, learn your lessons, but have fun too. May it be so.